Welcome to Authorial Intentions, a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and today I'll be talking with Christopher Paris about his recent book, Narrative Obtrusion in the Hebrew Bible. Chris has taught several courses at Vanderbilt, including The Bible in American Culture, Literary Analysis of the Hebrew Bible, and Leadership in the Hebrew Bible and the Ancient Near East. Currently, he teaches online courses at Excelsior College and Madisonville Community College, and in the spring, he'll be teaching biblical studies for Urshan College and the Urshan Graduate School of Theology. Chris, thanks for being willing to be interviewed.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
Great. Your book is an example of narrative criticism of the Hebrew Bible. I wonder if you could talk a bit about what narrative criticism is, where it came from, what it focuses on, what it's reacting against, and how you got interested in using it in reading biblical texts.
Well, when we think about narrative criticism, we're thinking about the role of the narrator and typically things that we would think about in literary criticism, such as characterization and plot. And often when we look at the role of the narrator from a narrative critical perspective, we can see the artistry of the biblical narrator. And one of the things that narrative criticism is reacting against is historical criticism. Historical criticism has tended to look at the text and to talk about different parts of the text and to split it up. And narrative criticism, on the other hand, has focused on the unity of the text and the artistry of the narrator. And it's kind of interesting because historical criticism has often been referred to as literary criticism, in spite of the fact, as many scholars have noted, it really has nothing to do with the literary aspects of the text. So narrative criticism is trying to redeem some of these aspects, and not to say that we don't owe a great debt to historical critics because they've done some very foundational work, such as in Hermann Gunkel's Form Criticism. Gunkel raised a lot of questions that we might ask in narrative criticism, but historical criticism never went that far. Ironically, it was two scholars who aren't really biblical scholars in their training. Eric Auerbach, who wrote Mimesis, and his essay Odysseus's Scar is considered the departure point for narrative criticism because he was talking about the literary aspects of the text. And then probably the person we owe the greatest debt to is Robert Alter. His book, The Art of Biblical Narrative, noticed the artistry of the biblical narrator and challenged many of the ideas of historical criticism. And I first got interested in this topic by taking a class with Jack Sasson on the book of Genesis, reading Robert Alter's The Art of Biblical Narrative. And in reading Alter and having discussions with Dr. Sasson, was able to answer a question that I had about a particular text from Judges 14, the story of Samson. And Samson goes down to a Timnite woman, and he wants to marry her and ask his parents to arrange the marriage. And then the narrator interrupts the text to say, "But all this was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines." And whenever I read that text, I was curious as to what it meant, as to why the narrator had intruded it at this point. And by reading Alter and talking to Dr. Sasson, was able to formulate a thesis which became part of the book.
Okay, great. Now, you've talked about narrators as central to narrative criticism, and in fact, your work is, as you say, predominantly concerned with narrators. And I think a lot of folks have a pretty good idea or think they have a pretty good idea of what a narrator is. They may have heard or they probably heard about narrators from literature classes, the omniscient narrator and first-person narrators. Generally speaking, how have narrators in the Hebrew Bible been characterized?
The general characterization of narrators in the Hebrew Bible is that they're laconic, they're terse, they're economical, they don't really say a lot. In fact, in many cases, we only know the narrator is there because the narrator is introducing dialogue, writing something like, "And David said." And it's very fascinating to think about the Bible in this way because when we go into a course at the Divinity School or the Graduate Department of Religion, we could discuss one verse and we would have so much commentary about this one verse, and yet the narrator is not making a lot of this commentary telling us how to read the text. The narrator is generally fading into the background. And what narrative criticism has tried to do is to recognize the artistry of the narrator and the economy that is going on, and to see the real value of what the narrator is doing, even though the narrator is trying to remain hidden.
Okay. Now, you suggest that narrative criticism, as it's traditionally been practiced, may not be sufficient at getting at what you want to say about the narrator. So you propose using it in concert with another critical approach that's called reader response criticism. What is reader response criticism, and how do you see narrative criticism and reader response working together?
Well, the main way I'm looking at reader response criticism in my dissertation is to think about the way that readers contribute meaning to the text. In many cases, the narrator relies on the reader to fill in gaps in the text, and the narrator is oftentimes just allowing the reader to do these things, which may be why we have the laconic narrator in the Hebrew Bible. But what I want to look at is those cases where the narrator may not be comfortable with the way the reader fills in these gaps. And it could be because the reader is knowledgeable. For example, we have a note in Joshua about the Anakim, who were giants, and it talks about them being wiped out. However, it has a little note there that says, well, except in the Philistine cities. And so we know that Goliath of Gath can then arise later on in the story. So the narrator is anticipating a knowledgeable reader. In other cases, the narrator is worried about a theologically presumptuous reader. The reader may not interpret the text the way the narrator wants. And in this case, the narrator will leave this laconic mode and try to influence the way the reader understands the text.
So we've got just looking at the narrative itself isn't enough to get you at what the reader is thinking about it and how that can influence what the narrator is doing. Is that a fair...
Yes, that's fair. And also to think about the narrator as the first reader of the text that's being composed. The narrator is looking at the text and recognizing that the narrator may have a question about what's going on and try to offer an explanation as to why this is happening. Something additional that I do is to think about characters as readers of narration. For example, we'll have David being told of Saul's death, and he will have a definite response to the narrative that is being told. So there are a variety of ways that I've combined the two criticisms in the book.
Okay. Now, you've already suggested the whole issue of obtrusion when you were talking about the Samson in the book of Judges. And your book is called Narrative Obtrusions in the Hebrew Bible. So what is a narrative obtrusion, and what kinds of purposes do these obtrusions serve?
Well, first of all, narrative obtrusions are omniscient comments, but they're not just merely omniscient comments that give you basic information about the story. They're designed to influence reader response. So they're addressing potential issues in the text that could create problems for the reader. These questions may arise because the narrator believes that the reader may ask these and will create additional issues, and they may be because of assumptions that the narrator fears that the reader may have about the text. So the narrator goes beyond omniscience and is a little more forceful and is obtruding into the text. You know, for example, we might have an omniscient comment that tells us, "Oh, this is how maidens in Israel dressed in those days." That is just general omniscience, but obtrusion, as we saw in Judges 14:4, saying, "Oh, this is of the Lord that he's going down to this Timnite woman," is much more forceful than just general omniscience.
Okay. And you develop a methodology for identifying narrative obtrusions, and you show it in action with several scripture passages. So I wonder if you could demonstrate this methodology a little bit with a different passage than the Judges one, although you go into some detail in the book on the Judges one. But if you could talk a little bit about the one Auerbach is concerned with in his work, Genesis 22:1. How do you come down on whether there is a narrative obtrusion there? What's going on in that passage that makes you think there's a narrative obtrusion? How do you use your methodology to come to that conclusion?
Yes, Genesis 22:1, and after these things, God tested Abraham, course, it's a very famous story, not only dealt with Auerbach, but by generations of biblical scholars. And once again, I'm saying that this comment is going beyond general omniscience because it's trying to influence the way the reader is viewing this text. And there could be problems with the way the reader views this text if you, for example, did not have this note that God is testing Abraham as God is telling Abraham to go sacrifice Isaac. It would raise unpleasant questions about the divine that the narrator is not comfortable with the reader asking. And so the narrator obtrudes to foreclose these questions. Or, well, we might say attempts to foreclose these questions. Obtrusions aren't always successful. And we might say that it's also important that the divine is invoked because this happens in other obtrusions. We just have an instance here where the divine is actually a character in the story. And so the narrator doesn't want the reader to ask these unpleasant questions, and so this is why the narrator is obtruding. I've also noted that location is very important in an obtrusion. And here, this issue is so worrying to the narrator that the narrator, before we even get into the story, has said God has tested Abraham in making this whole request or command for a sacrifice a test. We can imagine what if we moved that statement to the very end of the story and said, oh, and all of this was just a test. God was just testing Abraham. The narrator could have done that, but the narrator was so worried about raising these questions that the location became extremely important for what the narrator was doing. Additionally, we can also look at reception history and see how ancient readers have responded to this text. And when we see this, they're not satisfied with this explanation that God tested Abraham. They often want to invoke some kind of evil figure to explain the testing. And it shows a desire in many cases for sharper obtrusions. And of course, we know even as modern readers, we notice the ethical issues that we raise about this text. So it was a problem for the narrator. The narrator tried to address it, but perhaps wasn't completely successful.
So maybe, later readers had problems with the obtrusion that the narrator introduced and wanted to obtrude themselves. So some of the things that the narrator was trying to get the reader to avoid thinking about. I mean, what are some of those things in this particular passage?
In this particular passage, I think it's not to think anything bad about the divine. Perhaps some people have talked about child sacrifices. We're not even wanting to bring up that issue at all, and to think about it as being very different. In other cases, the narrator protects a favored character. God, of course, would be a favored character in this story, but we see something similar happening in the narratives of David, where the character of David is protected. Don't think this bad about David. He didn't have anything to do with the death of Abner. And it's also a theme of divine causality. God is responsible for everything. Mm. God is in control of this situation, even though God is acting in this text, telling Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. God still has this grand control over everything that will occur.
Okay. Now, what kind of assumptions do you need to make about narrators and audiences for narrative obtrusions to make sense? I mean, you're talking about so far we're talking in a kind of abstract way about narrators and audiences, but as you know, better than probably a lot of other people, narrators come out of particular times and contexts, and you have actually, as you've just suggested, audiences throughout history. I mean, you have people reading these texts from their first, perhaps, oral versions to today. So which audiences are we talking about? What kind of assumptions are you making, or what kind of, maybe not assumptions, but what are your ground rules for defining the narrator and the audience that you're interested in?
Looking at a narrator who is artistic and has constructed text in a particular way and goes into a great deal of pains to do this, but at the same time in constructing the text trying to remain hidden And here's an instance where the narrator is breaking the narrator's own rule by intruding in the text. So this is an anomalous action that we're dealing with when we're discussing the narrator. So we kind of have our portrait of the terse narrator, mm-hmm. and now we're kind of breaking that idea. And the narrator, I think, is going against the general way of doing things, because the narrator is looking towards a reader that will know a lot about the text and has knowledge about the text. In addition to the example of the Anakim, the giants, and Goliath of Gath, we might have a chance to look at the example in Joshua where it explains why Jerusalem wasn't conquered, to leave it for David to be done. So the narrator, I think, is looking at a reader who knows a great bit of the narrative history of ancient Israel and is responding to that. The narrator is also assuming that the reader might not only be knowledgeable, but could be theologically presumptuous, and that could be a bad thing in the case, as we mentioned in Genesis 22, of thinking the wrong thing about God, or from a political perspective, thinking the wrong thing about David and his motivation for acting.
Talk a little bit about the, since you've raised it, talk a little bit about the Joshua Jerusalem point that you talk about in the book. What's going on there? Go ahead.
Well, we have this explanation as to why Jerusalem could not be conquered, which, when you have it in the story of Judges, we have, as the narrative goes, this seemingly sweeping conquest of ancient Israel, but this major city, Jerusalem, it has not been conquered, which seems very odd as to why that would not have happened, because it's such an important city later on, and of course even to today. And so the narrator is interrupting the text to explain why this didn't occur, and also we might say has a foreshadowing effect to what would happen with David. And perhaps it's because that the narrator knows the reader is knowledgeable and will think about this, and we could see a narrator responding to a reader question about, well, why didn't this happen at this point? Why was it left for David?
Mm-hmm. You spend the majority of the book talking about some specific examples from the Hebrew Bible, but then you, in your last chapter, survey narrators in a variety of ancient Near Eastern texts, and you say you characterize narrators in a variety of civilizations. The discussions you have, although it's quite brief, particularly intrigued me, and that had to do with the whole notion of a negative obtrusion. What is a negative obtrusion? And you don't go into this, maybe because there isn't any biblical evidence for such a thing, but I was curious whether there were examples of negative obtrusions in the Hebrew Bible.
A negative obtrusion would be a case where the narrator interrupts the text and it's obvious that the narrator has intruded into the text to provide a particular piece of information. This piece of information is essential to keep the story moving forward. However, it's not really influencing reader response. It's kind of this hollow comment that is just there to say, okay, this is a brief explanation. Let's keep the plot moving. The example that I use in the book is from a text called The Poor Man of Nippur. And in the text, the poor man has been wronged by a politician. Mm-hmm. And so he is attempting to address this issue, and he has a plan. And so part of his plan is to rent a chariot from the king. And this would seem very odd that a poor man could, convince a king to rent a chariot. But the text just tells us, the king didn't ask him what he was going to do or anything. It just, has this negative obtrusion. We don't get to know, did the king just laugh at him and then decide to give it to him just to see what would happen? Did the king question him about it? No, he just did it to keep the story moving on. As to the case of where negative obtrusions might appear in the Hebrew Bible, I'm sure it may be possible, because I can't say that I found everything, because it's such a vast text. I would say it's possible that they did exist in an oral tradition, because it seems in this text of the poor man of Nippur that it would be very easy for someone who's orally telling the story to just quickly dismiss this issue for the audience and continue moving on with the story, keep the plot moving, and get back to the main ideas of the story.
Okay. Now, a combined narrative critical, reader response critical approach, as you've suggested, would seem to have strengths over using either of the approaches alone. We haven't really talked about reader response alone and where that gets you. But do you see any limitations to just using these two approaches? And if so, how can you see addressing them in some kind of future work?
Yeah, I think that they've worked well with the parameters that I have set forth in talking about the comments made by the narrator. However, I can see where the study could be expanded because I've tried to just look at comments directly made by the narrator and not cases where the narrator has commandeered the voice of a character. There are cases where this happens in the Hebrew Bible. I reflect on a few of them. There are additional ones such as in the story of Rahab in the book of Joshua. We have, you know, some of her speeches which, you know, appear direct taken to be taken directly from Deuteronomy. And so I think that would be a worthwhile study to do, to think about how the narrator may take on the guise of character and what that might mean. So I see, you know, a potential future work as obtrusive speech in the Hebrew Bible. I also think as to the question of the limitations of these methodologies, I were to go back to historical criticism and look at different textual traditions, I think that could reveal additional obtrusions that I just wouldn't find by using narrative criticism and reader response, since narrative criticism is generally viewing the text as a whole. Textual criticism might, and other historical critical methods, redaction, they might really be a way of finding additional obtrusions and thinking about various reasons as to why these obtrusions might have been employed. I also think that reception history gives us a lot to look at. The various ways that readers throughout history have interpreted the text could add a lot to this study and maybe also allow us to ask questions. Why did the narrator leave this gap here that didn't seem to be a problem for the narrator or ancient readers, and yet modern readers may have a problem and really want to address this gap?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess one curiosity I always have is when you talk about, not you specifically, but when folks talk about ancient audiences, it would be kind of nice to have a better sense of these audiences and their reading habits, or, you know, what they were like, because it seems so much that we need to reconstruct from the texts that we have. And the text that we have is the Hebrew Bible, and then maybe other texts from other ancient Near Eastern civilizations. So the kinds of reader response seems a little bit different than what you might get with a reception history. I mean, the kinds of things you might get from seeing how folks now read texts. There just seems to be more data, I guess. Do you kind of feel that way as well? Or
I think you're right, and I think the point you bring up is a way for historical criticism and narrative criticism to work together. One of the things that Robert Alter has done in The Art of Biblical Narrative is to talk about particular type scenes. Mm-hmm. These are, you know, typical scenes that would appear in the ancient world. For example, men usually meet their wives at a well. That is significant. We have several type scenes throughout history, not in the Bible, obviously, but the type scene of a great leader being put in a vessel set adrift and found by adoptive parents. This is, of course, the story of Moses from the Bible, but we also have Sargon of Akkad. We also have Karna from India in this story. And of course, it's what's interesting in the modern world is this type scene has made its way into the Superman mythology, where Superman is put in a vessel and set adrift. So Alter has talked about understanding the way ancient readers want to understand stories and would recognize these particular areas. And I think a greater understanding of ancient Eastern literature and historical criticism could give us more windows into what day-to-day life was like. And if we understand day-to-day life, we might be better readers of the stories.
Okay. I did want to ask one final question, which is, what are you working on now? What projects are you dealing with now?
Well, I taught the class here at the Divinity School on leadership and the Hebrew Bible and the ancient Near East, and the class mainly focuses on Jotham's fable in Judges chapter 9, which is a paradigm for leadership. It talks about you have these trees, you have a fig, an olive, and a vine, and some of the other trees come and they want them all to be the leader in this area. And each of these trees refuses because they don't want to give up something such as their fruitfulness, their anointing, or wine, making people happy to be leaders. And so ultimately they go to the thorn bush, and the thorn bush agrees to be the leader, but warns them of, you know, the cost. If, you know, the thorn bush is betrayed, there will be fire. And I've seen this text interpreted and have lots of great conversations with the wonderful students in the Divinity School here about this text. But one of the ways it can be interpreted is that good leaders provide shade and protection, and they avoid starting fires. And so I want to look through the text and to think about, you know, how have biblical leaders addressed these issues. It's particularly important when you have the nation of Israel. It is surrounded by superpowers throughout history, so you're trying to provide shade and protection for your own people. You're trying to avoid starting fires with the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Egyptians. So it's a good way to think about leadership in the ancient world, and also from a practical level as well. What can we learn from these texts? What do we have in our own modern-day world even, where we try to provide shade and protection and also provide opportunities for fruitfulness and prevent from starting fires in these areas? And so I think it's a great study that I'd like to do. And from both, you know, the historical perspective of the Hebrew Bible and what we could practically learn from it in today's world.
Great. Well, Chris, thanks again for this conversation.
Thank you.
Again, I've been talking with Chris Paris about his recent book, Narrative Obtrusion in the Hebrew Bible, published by Fortress Press in their Emerging Scholars series. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Ask a Librarian link on that page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.